You're talking about the Tafts.
Yes, even though they were carried administratively different than the MAG personnel, but they were treated just as though they were in terms of where they lived and so on, except that a lot of the TAC people were, for example, they were located on an Air Force base. There were some minor problems there about not understanding the different cultural practices. Occasionally those flared up again in Tehran or elsewhere, but generally they were taken care of without any problem. But I think, you see, my basic contention was that that the programming of the primarily equipment for the forces. Now, we did get into how many, let's say, squadrons of aircraft and so on were needed. My contention was that the equipment should not be agreed to nor provided until we saw that the plans had been made for the personnel to be there on hand. And that then if you did do that, and if you did go into a stepped-up program, then there would be need for additional advisors. That's the reason that the TAF team became very important, you see. So you go back to the basic question about the extent to which, particularly in the later years, there were any restraints placed on the country. Now, this is a very critical factor. If a country feels that you are denying them equipment for your own reasons, as opposed to trying to assess their problem, then there is a question of suspicion and concern. So you have to be able to establish your credibility if you try to say that, you know, there's a need for restraining this at this time. And that was the basic rationale that I had with the two ambassadors, which they supported. It was necessary to pace this. On the latter in the 70s, there's been much discussion about whether or not, under the Nixon Doctrine and so on, that the decision was given to the Shah to buy anything he wanted. I've read the pros and cons on it, but basically I think it was trying to go too fast. Now, a lot of people attribute that factor to which led to the downfall of the Shah, if the issue was far more complicated than just that.
Yeah. When you met with the Shah from time to time, did he discuss his perceptions of military or security threats to Iran?
He discussed the question of concern over the threat on the west, the problem on the east.
I think you touched upon earlier.
Yeah. And the question of the Soviets and what he was trying to do there. Of course, in light of what had happened with our tilting towards India and the Pakistani-Indian conflict, 71, I think it was, and in 65 again. But I have to check the dates on that. But there was this concern about the steadfastness of the U.S. commitment, the reliability of it.
Did he raise those concerns with you? Directly? Or?
In one particular case. It's just a matter of a commitment, and then whether or not we would follow through. So it did come up.
You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but what did you think about his assessment of threats.
I thought that he had a, well, naturally, he's going to see things in a more dire circumstances than would somebody whose responsibility is 8,000 miles away in terms of effect. But I think he had a pretty good understanding of these, of the geopolitical situation. And again, his desire to be able to one, deter any attacks on either flank, and to, again, in hopes that a sufficiently strong force would deter the Soviets in recognition that he would have to call on the West for help. Now, as time grew on, particularly in the 70s, he started thinking more about the defense of the Gulf and extending out into the Indian Ocean, more for the protection of supplies coming into the country and for the oil going out. So that's the reason he moved towards this blue water navy. That was just developing when I was there. This was when he started thinking about larger ships, going out into the beyond the entrance to the Gulf. In the earlier days, it had been primarily the protection within the Gulf itself.
Now,
the only other thing is he placed great stress on the civic action roles of the particularly the army. It's kind of a random thought. In strategic terms, he thought primarily in terms of the Air Force because of distances involved, and again, its deterrent role.
Like my reading, I have the impression that the civic action was encouraged to some extent by the Amish-Mag earlier in the 60s as part of counterinsurgency training or thinking generally.
Well, I think probably this was a factor, but it was also in terms of it did a number of things in terms of just civic enhancement, and I think that this was an important factor. Education, medical assistance. Again, you see, you get into a whole combination of factors that are different in our part. The number one man in aviation in the country was the chief of the Air Force, including civil aviation. The program that he had for for the schools and so on, all of those activities which he visualized as important socially and also an economic development program. He used the military as kind of, if you will, an advance, a point, if you will, of the technical and economic, the technical development of the country, both for the economic and civilian economic as well as the military aspect.
That's right. Now, at this time, did any of the Amish-Mag programs include counter-insurgency training in a more narrow sense, or was that already? I think there had been earlier in the decade, maybe.
But primarily ours was particularly in terms of conventional military training.
Okay. And what were your impressions of the Shah around this time? Had he changed much since you first met him in the early 60s?
I didn't. I just saw him, on two occasions.
Yeah.
They were much the same. Well, I can only give my impressions that one, as I saw him as a public figure when during ceremonies and so on. Two, as I saw him in his office.
Mm-hmm.
Then two, then three, the way he related to his command. During the audiences, it was a very easy discussion. I But I never felt I inhibited in saying what I thought the problems were, what needed to be done to solve them. And he was very open to them. At least there was a good deal of discussion back and forth about them. In public, he had, you know, he pretty much developed the manner of being very far removed. And this gave him the feeling of imperialism for which he was criticized, not so much by the people. The Iranian people never were too critical, at least to me, of him. Or I think probably most Americans. Although I did meet with a lot of people who, you know, from time to time they would say something to indicate that they had different views about particularly the need for the government being more open than it is, was. The royal family, you know, most of these things that came out in the latter part of the 70s.
Yeah.
My own feeling was that from these in the middle, say 73, 74, 75 period, when the Shah began talking about Iran becoming one of the six major powers in the world and so on, that this I'm not quite sure what brought it on, but it seemed to me that the pace that he set was somewhat influenced by the fact that he knew he was ill, and he wanted to have the machinery put in place before he died or left the throne, and that his son could take over. For example, you talk about types of things you talk about. One time we talked, this was shortly after but at least it was shortly after the event of a birthday celebration or something, and the question of the education of his son came up. And we had a long discussion about what sort of an education it takes, what sort of an environment it takes to bring somebody up to meet the responsibilities that he was expected to run into.
Now, at this time, the time you were stationed in Iran, how secure did you think his political position was, generally? The problems you had talked about, you said there were problems earlier in the 60s that you perceived.
Yes, I think the embassy perceived them as well. That there were difficulties. That I think the general feeling was that a lot was being accomplished economically. There was criticism of the alleged corruption, people in Lahai, the royal family, that by and large his principal in the government and the military were reluctant to tell him anything unpleasant. I don't know how much he asked them for advice, you know. That's something else. I do know that there were a number of times when it was suggested that I could say something to the Shah that they couldn't. Again, you know, this question of the discussion very frequently about the capability of particularly the military commanders, and that he put his friends into position. Well, I think if you go back and see the threats which have occurred to him in the past, and especially the intrusion of foreign powers into the inner workings of the government, could lead to that. So one of the critical criteria was loyalty. The other impression I had, he was too much involved in detail throughout the running of the government, particularly the military. But during the time I was there, they moved from the appointment of colonels to brigadier generals, for example, to having exams for them. And these exams were given once a year, and it counted pretty heavily in the selection process. So these things were moving slowly until the economy started to overheat. There had been all these promises made, which were vastly evaporated.
You mentioned the problem of loyalty a minute ago. The loyalty of the military leaders to the Shah.
Yes.
Was he concerned about that problem? Did he perceive?
I never had that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think all the people that he had, he felt loyal to.
But in general, during this period, you thought that did you have the sense that his position was fairly secure?
I didn't think that there was any threat which would indicate that he would be overthrown. I think that there were these signs of unrest and concern.
Did you see any evidence of political opposition when you were there during those 3 years?
For example, they tried to, the Mujahideen tried to run the ambassador's car off of the road. While I was there, there were a couple of incidents with the people in the mission. The Iranians became concerned and really insisted on the three service chiefs and myself having a security escort whenever he went out. I very frequently would walk part of the way to work, which caused a lot of unhappiness, but I just felt I didn't want to have to go every time I wanted to do something, go someplace. So if it was a tight situation, the families there, the wives there in particular, became nervous in the sense that they couldn't do things with freedom in many cases. They weren't encouraged to drive their own cars and so on. Not so much because of a security problem, but just because of the general difference in the culture. But people, the wives, went down to shop and so on their own. So, but it was a restricted society for the American community.
Now, some analysts argued back in those days, and political scientists who looked at Iran closely, some argued that as long as the Shah ruled on a monarchical basis and prevented widespread political participation, that it was really impossible for him to forge a durable, stable political system in the long term. Did this kind of a problem trouble you back then, or?
First of all, they tried. They went through a series of trying to adopt our system, or some phrase, a two-party system. Oh, it didn't work.
Yeah.
Then, after I got back here, they went to the one-party system, Rasta Key, and everybody said that's just a phony. My own feeling is that many of the academicians tried to judge everybody too much by our standards and our values. And that somehow you had to understand that one, what necessarily applies to us doesn't apply to everybody else. And so how do you deal with that? And at the same time, not just because we're going to give aid and assistance to some country, insist on our way of doing things. I think I may have mentioned to you, I'm not sure. But an example, like a very simple example, in Korea, somebody sawing a piece of wood has a solid, it's completely, it's not like we do it, it's like it's a different way, you see. And so the advisors try to change this. Well, it was very difficult. And I think that, and I've often meditated about this, this question, who lost Iran? I've heard that phrase used. Was it our fault, or was it the Shah's fault, or what? Well, of course, we get right down to it, it was the Shah's had the ultimate responsibility. But when there was a recognition, at least from what I saw, and I could almost document this, whether it was talk of it made here in the United States, that there was need for political change. Once you start this process, though, it's very hard to control it. And when you look back at those events in 78, what triggered off that fire down in Abadan, the speech by Humayun, one of the doctors, Humayun, criticizing, I've forgotten who it was, but it was a critical speech. These little things touched off.
Oh, criticizing the religious leaders of the Ayatollahs? Or,
yeah.
Right.
This just touched off a reaction which became uncontrollable. So I haven't really studied that part, but that phase, but I have been very interested in looking at the problems that arose during the 70s, one during the Nixon administration regarding the encouragement to, or at least being party to their going all out economically and militarily, and then the problems that arose in the Carter regime.
Now, when you arrived, Johnson was president.
Yes.
This was last year in my office, and Nixon became president the following year. How would you, could you see any differences in the approach that the Johnson administration took to Iran compared to Nixon in the following year? Were there any major changes in policy during this period?
Well, I would say that the major difference that I noticed was with regard to the purchase of equipment. The Nixon administration took the position that the purchases could be made direct from companies to Iran, to the government. It was pretty clear to me that in the first case, the Iranians really did not have the background and the capability to make the technical judgments on the equipment, whether they were buying American equipment or whether they were buying Italian equipment or somebody else's equipment. And as you can see, in the past, earlier, most of this was done through the Defense Department. That then, as a result of that, one of the issues that came up in connection with some sophisticated aircraft was some concern about the ability, concern over the sale of some earlier aircraft. And based on the problems that had arisen, at the request of the Iranians, General MacArthur, Admiral Ambassador MacArthur and I recommended that the Iranians be authorized to purchase equipment, as were the Germans at that time, through the Defense Department, if they so desired. And so that was afforded. Now, in that sense, in that degree, they did not, and then this assured them at least the government stood behind its force. But there, because of the intense competition for sales out there, British, French, Soviets in terms of product and value, it was to the interest of the United States in the long run to be sure that they felt that they were getting, a program which was in the mutual interest of the two countries, and that it was not something in which they wished that they hadn't bought. Because I saw cases where they bought equipment that they thought was all right, and it wasn't. Mm-hmm. That they bought equipment that didn't have the capabilities. For example, a helicopter that couldn't really take off and fly in during the heat of the summer in high altitudes. So in many cases I found that I had reservations over some of the equipment they were trying to buy and some of the equipment that people were trying to sell them.
But you said there's this change whereby the government of Iran would make purchases directly for American companies. This happened while you were there?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then...
Yeah. Well, this was...
I was going to say, but then it was changed that they could buy, if they wanted to, through the Defense Department.
So they had an option. How are we for time?
It's about 11:45.
Okay. In general, how did the Shah go about making his decisions on weapons purchases? From your observations at that time?
Well, generally, of course, the Air Force was almost U.S. Most of the Army equipment was U.S. provided. However, time I was there in 62 and the time I came back, they had purchased a lot of Soviet equipment. But again, there were limitations which the Iranians imposed on the types of Soviet equipment that they would buy. I'm sure that there were political factors as well as military factors in many of the decisions. Whether they bought a British tank or an American tank.
Can you give an example of how that would work out?
Whether they bought the Chieftain tank or the latest U.S. tank, you see. It might be a time factor. I think there was a concern on the part of the Shah whether or not, well, I'm sure there was a concern in terms of the escalation of the prices. Uh-huh. And you got into this question then of the chicken and egg between the price of oil and the increased prices. There was concern on his part about the reliability of the U.S. as a supplier, which would vary by administration. So this tended to make him try to buy faster. There was also pressure by companies to say, you know, we better buy it now because whatever, the price is going up and so on. But basically, Tupanian was the essential man on procurement. And I think he had the Shah's confidence on it, and they sought the advice of the MAG on many of these items. terms of his characteristics, capabilities, and so on.
Well, how much influence did you have over the finance of the Shah's decisions when they made a purchase? Did they seek your advice often? Or
very often. Yeah. Most of the time. Practically all the time. Maybe once. Very seldom otherwise.
How would you assess your influence?
I've never really felt that you could assess that.
Yeah.
I think that
were there instances when they disregarded your suggestions, or was that pretty exceptional?
I think there were a number of times when it came to the point where it was not a matter of our saying, here are the options, and then they had to make the decision. For example, whether you bought a British weapon or an American weapon. Obviously, we tried to, if they asked for a comparison, I gave them what I consider to be a professional comparison. And then they had to take into consideration some of the other factors. But I think the majority of the time that they accepted the recommendations. Now, for example, on personnel, my 2 years were up in June of 60, normally a 2 year term it was. That was 70. Then the ambassador earlier asked if I would stay on for another year. I said that I would. The last year I was there, then I got involved in several studies which the Shah wanted and which the U.S. was anxious to accord him, particularly regarding personnel. So when it came time for me to leave in June of 71, there were these studies which we were trying to work out with the Iranians, particularly personnel. The budget, I tried to get a 5-year budget programs, and then this question of personnel. These took longer than we anticipated because of the problems of working it out with the Iranians. So I was extended twice. One, I guess, from I was going to go back in April, and then I was moved to the summer, and then again to the end of October, end of September.
71.
So you ask how well did they implement. I don't ever know how well they implemented the personnel factor, but we did try to set up a personnel program for them that would meet the long-term proposition of career people who were were competent.
Now, in other interviews, I've heard a fair amount about the joint annual review of Iranian military purchases. I guess mostly from the United States, in terms of American credit American credit availability, export-import bank loans, and so forth. You were involved in this procedure for, I guess this was still going on when you were a Commerce Bank chief.
But basically, then you got down to what were the priority needs, what was jointly agreeable to them and to us. And again, it acted as a restraint on how fast the Iranians could go. In other words, but I guess the more important thing was to try to relate this to their ability to handle it as well as their ability to pay for it. And of course, in the latter part, then all constraints were off, particularly in 71 and so on, when the oil price hike took place.
Was the joint review procedure phased out while you were there?
Was
the joint review procedure phased out while you were there? Or to continue all the way through your, I think it was in 1970 the last?
I think it was.
It was the last joint review. Yeah.
Because then you see they were paying for everything.
That's right.